This is Brock and Salk
from the Alaska Airlines Studio.
Streaming everywhere at 710sports.com and the 710 Seattle app.
Oh, it's Brock and Salk, 710 ESPN Seattle. This hour is brought to you by Precor Home Fitness. Wassel is in for Brock today. We are over at training camp once again. Man, they're playing a game in just a few days. We're taking our mind off some of the Mariners' struggles and foibles here, dropping 3 out of 4 to Toronto. It was an ugly, ugly weekend for them, just salvaging a win yesterday. I don't envy you sitting with Bob for 3 hours today after that. He's going to be a quaking mound of rage.
He'll be okay.
I don't know. These are the type of things Bob says are unacceptable.
They are unacceptable, but he's only going to be slamming his fist. He'll only be a danger to himself or others the night of the game.
Okay.
We're talking, you know, the next day he's usually okay.
He's chilled out by then. But it will be unacceptable. I know that.
Unacceptable.
It's unacceptable behavior.
He will emphasize the loss to an inferior team, a clearly inferior team. I will not do that as much, but we'll both be equally distraught.
You know, Tom and I spent most of the day yesterday together playing golf and hanging out. We spent some time talking about the Seahawks. And I think one of the things we both realized as we were talking together is that we're pretty interested in this team in a different way than it's been for the last few years. They seem likable. They've got a lot of new guys, and the players that we've talked to so far at camp, we've each sort of had a different grouping of players that we've talked to here. They seem to be good dudes. They seem excited about the season. They seem a little bit more humble, maybe, than the previous group was. But they still have enough of an edge and enough confidence to make me think that they can go out there and play some good football. And I don't think we know whether this team is going to be good.
I think part of being a sports fan is watching young players and young people develop, right, over the course of, say, 5-6 years. Sometimes in the NFL it's a little shorter. They don't hang around as long. But you think back to when Pete Carroll first got here. When he first got here, that 2010 team was just a hodgepodge of whoever.
The one where he kept bringing it, you know, they made more roster moves than anyone in the history of the NFL.
Right, you had Ben Obamanu, right? That whole crew, Mike Williams, everybody else. Yeah. Obamanu, yes, I know.
Leon Washington.
Right, but by the next year, Earl Thomas, Cam, Sherman eventually won that job, and we watched them grow into men. They each kind of went their own way, but they became champions together, and we kind of became champions with them.
And Ben Obamanu.
We assumed the personality of the team as fans, and I think that 2018 is another opportunity to sort of to do that again now, because enough time has passed, and like Mike said, we've interviewed maybe a dozen players, or maybe a little bit more than that, and they're humble enough, and they're focused, and they seem like the type of guys that at least I want to root for.
Yeah, and I think that's maybe why I'm so done with Earl Thomas.
Yeah.
He's not in that group. He's in all of his words and messaging and everything. Look, Earl's a great player. Don't get me wrong. I will never come out here and say Earl's not. I think he's a Hall of Famer. We'll talk more about it. But he's not in the same place in his life or whatever it is. He doesn't have the same energy right now that the other guys have that we're talking to. And so it makes me even less in Earl's corner when he's crowing about what he needs and what is going to protect his family. And then we sit here next to Tedrick Thompson, who just wants his mom to come up and see him play football because he's desperate to go out and play.
Right, which is not to say that one day Tedrick Thompson or Nas Jones or any of these guys might not be in that same situation. But like you just said, to me, having this Earl Thomas situation lingering over the whole team defeats the entire purpose of cleaning out the coaching staff.
Agreed.
And really hitting the reset button on the franchise.
I agree. And it's why I think they will end up trading him before the season begins.
Sure.
If they can get what they want for him or even something close to it. I think you're right. I think they will hopefully do that. But yeah, if the energy is different and they're at a different life cycle, I tend to think of, you know, even great players tend to have a life cycle, right? And at least with our relationship with them, you know, we kind of get to learn about, especially the ones that kind of come out of nowhere. I mean, maybe the LeBron Jameses who you've known since he was 13 years old or whatever, maybe theirs is a little different. But, you know, with a lot of the players here, they sort of show up. You don't really know who they are. You get to know them just like you do in the first movie, first installment of a superhero trilogy or series.
Right.
They are humble and eager and willing to do anything for the team, and they have nothing else going on in their life, and all they want to do is succeed. And then over time, then they have that success, and that's obviously incredibly fun once they get to the peak of their powers, and they're dominating on the field, and they're getting endorsements, and you're happy for them. And, you know, then they start having a family, or they, you know, they start believing their own press clippings.
Yeah, and life becomes a little bit more complicated.
They all want their money. Everything gets challenging. All of a sudden, it's like Goodfellas or something, like the end, the middle of Goodfellas, where everything's going wrong and there's too much money. Boogie Nights, the same movie, and then eventually you cut ties. Like eventually that they either they bring it back around and they have this, you know, incredible happy ending with the team that they were with, where they realize it. Or they move on, and there's some anger, and it's not until they come back later as a retired player that everybody truly is able to put it all behind them. It's just the life cycle, man. There's nothing personal. It's not negative. It's not about each individual guy. It's just the life cycle, and in Seattle, we haven't seen all that much of it, really. I mean, like, other than the Seahawks teams, the Holmgren teams, there haven't really been enough great teams with either the Mariners or especially with the Seahawks to really experience that whole life cycle.
And so now you're saying that we get another chance to add another group to that.
A little bit, and I think that's what I'm excited about.
Yeah, then there was the group in the 80s as well. I think that the underdog factor for us as fans, who doesn't love an underdog, right? I mean, who doesn't? That's one of the things that, even if you're a non-fan, you catch on with another team, a team that comes out of nowhere. I think that we have the opportunity to root for that type of team right now, and that window is so short.
Yes.
Because one of two things is going to happen. They're either going to get good and jump right out of that underdog phase, or they won't be good and they'll have to reset and reload with another group of players.
Absolutely.
That's kind of what the Mariners are. Right, every single year, I mean, there's a couple of guys who hang around, but it feels like every year we hit the reset button and there's at least five new key players that we got to learn their names, what they're about, get used to, and then hope that they, you know, play well.
Yeah, as I agree with that. Tom Wassel, and I'm going to get you guys on the horn here in a minute, but the last thing I'll say about this is it's maybe that vibe that is not just affecting my thoughts on Earl Thomas, but it's affecting my thoughts on Frank Clark as well. I wouldn't sign Frank Clark. I'd let him play out this year for sure, and then maybe I'd have a conversation at the end of the offseason, at the end of the season, depending on how this year goes. But I would put the vibe I get from him as being much closer to the Earl Thomas and the sort of older veteran vibe than the young players who are hungry and desperate to go out there and prove themselves. And it's sort of not being at the voluntary workouts, and then the late surgeries on his hand where he's sort of in and out of training camp. I don't know. It's just a vibe. It's not. I can't like pin it to anything specifically. But you asked me earlier, are Frank Clark and Tyler Lockett part of the old regime or the new one? And it's funny, Tyler Lockett feels like part of the new one, even though he's had success. Frank Clark seems to act like more of the old one.
Act like more, just based on his behavior? Because I could think you could make the argument that neither one of them have really reached their full potential yet.
In terms of on the field,
you're
right.
On the field, yeah.
I'm just talking about the feel they give me, and it's very unquantifiable. I can't give you an example or a reason why I think that way, but Frank Clark...
Is it because he was... I mean this in the most loving way possible, but is it because he was hanging around Michael Bennett too much?
Maybe.
Because yeah. Michael Bennett would be emblematic of the old guard.
Yeah.
Him and Sherman, but mostly Michael Bennett.
And again, I don't know who he hangs out with in his spare time.
Right.
I just meant
his position.
It's the feel that he generates is much more similar and definitely gives me a lot of pause before extending him. I don't think I would do that.
Yeah, the reason... to me, to not extend him is because he hasn't really played all that well yet. He hasn't played up to big money, right? If you came into the league and immediately you were this disruptive force, and he's been around since 2015, so he's played for 3 years.
Yeah. He's been good, not great.
He's been good, not great. And granted, at first he was stuck behind a couple of guys, used sparingly, but he never... I mean, if you're going to be that type of difference-making player, the coaches will know it.
Yeah.
They'll make sure you're out there. I haven't seen that yet.
It's so funny. I hate the word flash. It drives me crazy. It's one of these football buzzwords that everybody seems to throw out there, and it just drives me nuts. Like, oh, you know who flashed in practice today? Like, no, not really. I don't know. I just kind of watched. He is, though, one of those guys who flashes, where, like, he doesn't do anything for 20 minutes, and then all of a sudden you see him, like, toss him to offensive linemen, like, 5 yards behind the line of scrimmage and bury somebody. So you know that the ability is in there. It's just whether or not he can do it consistently. And I guess that's sort of part of my problem is I want the consistency. I want to see the Seahawks able to do all that stuff. So let me ask you this question. I'll throw it out to you, Tom, and then to the listeners as well, 206-421-3776. Are you willing to have a little grace with this team this year?
Are we still talking about the Seahawks?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Sorry. The Mariners, that's a whole different conversation. Are you willing to have some grace with the Seahawks this year if
yes.
the vibe is good,
yes.
if they play hard, if they say the right things, if it looks like they have some future players, if the Tedrick Thompsons of the world come out and look good, if the Rashad Penny or Chris Carson pops as a good running back, even if, you know, they don't have the pass rush. We were talking about it earlier with Mike Sando. They don't have the pass rush, and unfortunately, Deion Jordan can't stay on the field, and they just can't get to the quarterback, but you can really see where this thing is going, and if they're able to kind of add that position down the road, you can start to see that path back to success. Are you willing to have a little bit of grace with where the Seahawks are at, or is it the same as it's been the last year? Hey, win or else.
No, I've never been that absolute.
The last few years has been sort of win or else. Man, you went into every year for the last 5 years or so thinking this team should win 10 at an absolute minimum, and quite frankly, they should be able to win 12 or 13 games.
Maybe, but
They were in their window. Every loss stung more. It was at least that's how I felt, because I would pick them to win every single game.
I would too, but I didn't really feel that way as much last year. 15 and 16, maybe. But this year, the answer to your question is yes. I absolutely will have. Is it? I will have grace for them. Is that how I say that? Yeah.
Sure.
I've already predicted them to go 8-8, so my expectations aren't that high. And I've said a couple of times now how much I like the guys on this team. So when you combine those two things, I think very, very clearly I'm willing to be patient with them just as a fan. Now, there's one or two things I think I do need to see happen, and they work together. The offensive line needs to improve, and I need to see something out of Penny. Number one, their first draft pick.
Why?
I need to see something out of him.
What if Carson is so good that it doesn't matter?
I don't think that's going to happen.
But what if it does?
It won't.
What do you mean it won't?
It just won't.
Why?
Because it won't. I don't know. It's for the same reason you think Frank Clark is part of the old guard.
All right, but you think it won't as opposed to it won't. Like, I mean, it could. I mean, Chris Carson could be really good. Don't you think? You just don't buy it.
No.
Interesting.
I just...
You're one of the only people I've talked to who hasn't bought Chris Carson.
What's to buy? I mean, I haven't seen anything yet out of him. We saw him for four games last year. He had a nice game against San Francisco. I mean, he flashed in practice, according to everybody who's been here.
It's not just
that's
that.
That's really all.
He looks, when you watch him out there, I mean, look, I certainly don't have the trained eye of a Brock or someone like that. But
they can't tell either.
But when you watch him out there, he looks different, man. He looks fast. He looks jacked up. He put himself in even better shape. I mean, he's done sort of all the things you would do to set yourself up for a good year this year, in addition to being the guy who really, you know, jumped out last year and impressed everybody. So,
but the other part,
I
the other part about that
expectation level there,
maybe. But the other part of it with Penny is that I think this year's draft was about proving that John Schneider and Pete Carroll can still identify talent. Mm. Okay, and they're drafting a running back in the first round. If he ends up being a bust, then I have to go into every draft nervous. That the players, oh, well, we like, I know everybody else liked this guy, but we really like this guy. Really? Well, the last handful of guys that you really liked didn't work out.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's alarming to me. If Penny works out, then I'm feeling pretty darn confident in the rest of the team.
Interesting. I don't know that you'll be able to tell that after 1 year, but I think I understand what you're saying.
No, but I'm willing to be patient with it.
Yeah. No, it's an interesting point, and obviously, you know, he's a guy that is going to be under the microscope as sort of a out of the norm first round pick for the Seahawks. But very clearly, the running game was important to them. It was something they needed to fix. I told you I had a stat for you. So this came yesterday on Twitter. This is from Bob Sturm. You ready for this?
Old man Bob Sturm.
How bad was the Seahawks running game a year ago? Are you ready?
Mm-hmm.
The 2017 Seahawks had the second worst red zone rushing DVOA we had ever recorded, okay? But here's where, when I actually tell you the numbers, this will blow you away. They had 43 carries inside the red zone last year. In those 43 carries, how many yards did they have?
43 carries inside the red zone. Total yards?
Total yards.
43?
46.
Oh, my God.
They have 46 yards on 43 carries. But it gets worse. 29 of those yards came from either Russell Wilson or Tyler Lockett rather than running backs.
Tyler Lockett?
Yeah, he got
where they run a reverse?
A little end around. So that's 17 yards on 34 carries for the running backs.
What's 46 minus 17? I can't do the math.
They had 17 yards on 34 carries. The running backs did, Tom. 17 yards on 34 carries. That's half a yard per carry.
I don't even want to ask you what it was in between the 20s.
But wait, it gets worse. 20 of those 17 running back yards came from outside the 10. So inside the Seattle
inside
running backs carried the ball 20 times from inside the 10, okay? 20 times from inside the 10, they handed the ball to a running back. In those 20 carries, how many yards did they gain?
Well, there's only so many yards left.
-3. They ran the ball 20 times inside the 10 and gained -3 yards
in
total.
Is that counting Russell Wilson?
No,
that's not counting
Russell,
just the running back.
They handed off to a running back inside the 10 20 times.
It doesn't surprise me,
though. They gained -3 yards.
I know that, but are you surprised by that? You watched them.
It's unbelievable. And that doesn't include the penalties, by the way. That doesn't include however many times Jermaine Ifedi grabbed somebody and tugged at him and pulled him down. That is a truly awful. I mean, how do you win like that?
I don't know. Now, that's mostly not including Chris Carson because he only played, what, 4 games
that's
last year?
That's exactly right.
Yeah, so I won't use that as ammunition.
No, that's Eddie Lacy and Thomas Rawls and some of the others.
I know, and before people start taking what I said as, oh, you're rooting against Chris Carson, I'm not. I just look at a guy who's drafted that late up against a guy who's drafted first or first round, and I think it should be the guy in the first round working out.
All right, 206-421-3776. Can you find some grace for this year's Seahawks team? And I don't know, maybe I'm not phrasing that the right way, but
can you be patient?
Can you be a little bit more patient than you've been in the past? 206-421-3776. Grab Brad, who's in Ann Arbor. Good morning, Brad.
Hey, Mike. Love your show.
Thanks, bud.
I don't know if grace is the right word. I've been a fan since the early 80s, and this is where I feel comfortable. I think this was like, for decades, this was the feel. You had a young team or a team that might contend, might not contend, and you were just kind of hoping they would do well.
But you didn't have one or two things that this team has. You didn't have a franchise quarterback, a real legitimate top 3 to 5 franchise quarterback, and you haven't always had a coach at the level of Pete Carroll, right?
I don't know. I felt like Coach Knox was always knocking on the door. And so I don't know. Maybe we didn't have it quite as we have it now, but I feel more at peace this season than the last few, where I was nervous every game knowing that we were in the Super Bowl window and we got one. That's great. But now I feel like we're back at that stage where I can appreciate the wins. I can appreciate watching players get better. I'm so excited. I'm coming into Seattle the first time in my life to see this preseason game. And I feel like all 4 quarters, I can see players who might actually make this team because they're young and they're hungry, and it's just going to be a fun season in that respect.
Hold on. I gotta understand what you're saying. You're flying to Seattle. This is the first time you've ever been to Seattle?
Yeah, I've never been there before.
All right, so you've been a Seahawks fan since the 80s. You've never been to Seattle. You're coming for the very first time. And why not come for a regular season game?
It'd be too expensive, probably, first of all. Second of all, I think I'd have a heart attack at a regular season game.
It would be too much for you.
Why did you become a Seahawks fan?
Well, it's not a terribly interesting story, but in the early 80s, running around in the backyard as a left-handed quarterback, I was Jim Zorn, and my buddy was Steve Largent.
Wow.
And then human psychology takes over, and here I am decades later.
It must have felt amazing when the Seahawks drafted a young lefty out of Puyallup to be their quarterback in the third round.
I love Brock for that reason.
must have been heartily disappointing when his career went the way it did.
Yes, I was.
All right.
Rooting for sure.
Brad, thanks for the phone call, man.
Okay,
good luck. Have
you.
Fun at that preseason game. That's pretty cool story.
Bye-bye.
Good to hear.
Can I add something to that? He said he was comfortable at 8-8. I think a lot of this generation Seahawk fans are comfortable at, we'll say 11-5 or right in that area.
Absolutely.
You go in, like you said, you go in every year expecting to win the Super Bowl. I might be alone, and I'm not even sure if I believe this, but is it nice just for 1 year to not have
the
Super Bowl expectations?
Well,
it's a
nice
different
thing
vibe
about not having them is that they can exceed your expectations.
That's what I mean. To not go into every game and say, I can't believe they lost this game. You know what I mean?
There is nothing more fun than teams that exceed your expectations.
Of course.
As you know, like when the Mariners early this year were doing what they were doing, and I know it's sort of fallen off now, obviously, but when they were doing what they were doing and every night was a surprise, what's more fun than that? Like, do you think this team can win? No. And then they go out and win. You're like, oh, my God, that was awesome.
Right. We're proud of this team because there are underdogs. And they're not yours.
The flip side is, you know, which is worse? Having a team you don't expect to win that actually lives down to your expectation, or having a team that you do expect to win and then they lose? It's gut-wrenching.
Definitely.
Man. I mean, watching the last couple of years of Seahawks games where the expectation and everything that had been built in this town was all around them, and they weren't living up to the billing. And there's a lot of different reasons why. You and I will probably differ on a lot of them. But, you know, from Daryl Bevel to the running backs, and those stats in the red zone are just an atrocity, to the defense starting to fall apart, not coming up with enough turnovers, and not getting to the quarterback as much as they used to, and teams starting to figure out how to play against that defense without putting the ball into danger spots, to Russell Wilson's injury, to Richard Sherman squawking, and problems in the locker room. There have been a million reasons why this thing has gotten away from them from the last few years. And everyone in the world has denied, because nobody wanted to believe it was happening, because it's fun on Sundays to go out there and get excited for the game. But I guess I just wonder whether or not, and I think you're with me on this, whether or not it might actually be even more fun to show up ready for that game with no expectation as to what's going to happen. Maybe they're going to win. Maybe they're going to lose. Maybe Tedrick Thompson's going to play well. Maybe he's not. Maybe Delano Hill's actually going to get some playing time. Maybe one of these young wide receivers, and Amara Darbo, breaks out this year. Maybe we see something from I don't know who. One of the young, Frank Martin, the young kid who can rush the passer. Maybe Jacob Martin, thank you. I keep calling him Frank. Maybe Shaquem Griffin does something that we've never seen before in a football field. I mean, there's an element of surprise that I have to say has intrigued me more than ever.
Yeah, what was more fun, watching this defense come together a little bit in 2011 when they went 7-9, or watching them fall apart last year?
It was more fun in 2011
yes,
than 2012.
Yes, absolutely.
Even with Tavares Jackson in 2011, in a lot of ways that was more fun. But, you know, that doesn't do the 75 shares on game day.
No, not necessarily, but for the person who's going to watch anyway, watching a team come together and say, you know what, they've got something here, whether it's this year or next year, rather than watching a team fall apart and wonder whether or not your general manager can evaluate talent.
Gibb is in Indianola. Good morning, Gibb.
Morning, guys. How you doing this morning?
What's up?
Oh, man, I'd like to say I'm really positive on this year's outlook on our draft and everything, but my one point is, this is going to be the first time in 3 to 5 years where people aren't headhunting for us because we just won the Super Bowl or we're hot. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. You think that's a good thing?
Yeah, I do, man. I think it'll loosen up the teams a little bit, so we'll have a little bit more of a chance to do what we do and play and win, man.
I think the players won't have to come off the field after every loss and take it to heart and we'll have a come-to-you-know-who meeting about it. I mean, it won't carry that same pressure for them, or for the fans for that matter, yeah. I don't think.
It's going to be fun, I think. I'm looking forward to it in a very different way than it's been the last few years. So, I don't think about it. You guys can drop some texts on that. 710-710, powered by Coors Light. Brad, who called us from Ann Arbor. Brad, do me a favor. Call back the number, 206-421-3776. I'll need to talk to you about something, so give us a call back if you can. In the meantime, Tom, I want to talk about a legend, and a legend who is in a very precarious spot. We'll do it next on Brock and Salk.
From the Alaska Airlines Studio,
this is Brock and Salk.
Streaming everywhere at 710sports.com.
And the 2-2 pitch, strike three called. Felix Hernandez pumps his arms in the air. Felix has just thrown the first perfect game in Seattle Mariners history.
It was a heck of a moment, Felix Hernandez, a few years ago, throwing that perfect game, and seems like an eternity ago right now. It's Brock and Salk on 710 ESPN Seattle. This hour is brought to you by Precore Home Fitness, and Wassel is in hanging out for Brock today. That was a great day, and it was one of many incredible moments for Felix. I think what was so special about that is that it seemed to pay off a lot of the other days where he was magnificent and yet was never rewarded with the win. You know, Jacob DeGrom is going through that right now with the Mets. He's having this incredible season. He could be the first Cy Young Award winner in history to have a losing record. I mean, like, that's the kind of year DeGrom is having.
He's at least been to a World Series.
He has.
What did Morosi say? It was like over 200 innings, sub 2 ERA, and have less than 10 wins.
It's really crazy, remarkable what's happened to him. But you're right. That's just a one-year thing for DeGrom. As opposed to Felix, it felt like it was his entire career, year after year of great performances. And the team would either find a way to have the bullpen give it up late in that game or just not score any runs. And the team was never all that good. And just, you know, so many wasted games and wasted performances from Felix Hernandez. And you knew that, you know, there was a limit on them. You only get so many of those in every player's career. And unfortunately, when they're wasted, it hurt every single time with Felix.
Yeah, you want one or the other. You want the chance to pitch in the postseason and be recognized as a big game pitcher, kind of like a Curt Schilling, right? Mm-hmm. He never had a, I don't know if he ever had a no-hitter. I don't think he did, actually. But Felix at least got the perfect game out of the way, and here we are, chance to go to the postseason, and it's whether they make it or not, he really hasn't contributed.
Well, it's what makes what's happening now, I think, so interesting and so different from a lot of other pitchers. We've talked about that life cycle of players, and Felix is very clearly on the back end of that life cycle. It's come earlier than expected. He's only, 31 years old, and I think the expectation was that you would get more out of him, certainly when they signed him to that big deal that ends at the end of next season. And now we found ourselves in this really strange sort of back and forth spot on Felix. And I don't entirely understand why the Mariners have done what they've done here over the last couple of weeks, although I think I'm trying to. You know, from the outside, there is definitely a feeling of kind of hanging their star out to dry a little bit of, you know, well, is he in the rotation? Is he not? Everything seems sort of start to start and week to week. And, you know, Service saying, well, for now, this is going to be the case. And this is what Scott said after a sort of mediocre start on Thursday night.
You know, I think he commanded the ball a little bit better tonight, obviously, than he did last time out. Last time out, it wasn't very good at all. But, you know, he did compete. Again, I didn't think his stuff was particularly sharp. But he made pitches, and he did get through it. You know, curveball was okay at times. You know, had some depth to that. But, you know, the changeup was kind of, you know, hit and miss. It wasn't as good as we've seen in the past. But, again, you know, looking at where we're at and, you know, trying to get him back on track a little bit, he gave us a chance to win.
Look, Scott Service did not rip Felix Hernandez there. Far from it. But in baseball terms, he did.
Because he didn't come to his defense.
On the scale of the way baseball managers talk about star players, that's about as rough as it gets, especially coming off a game where he didn't pitch all that badly. I mean, he was okay on Thursday night. As Scott said at the end, he gave them a chance to win. And the message afterwards is about as low on the scale of praise as you can get from baseball manager to a, you know, veteran starting pitcher like that.
Usually a manager will come out and look for anything he can to cling to tell us, hey, but look at this. He had this. He had this. Didn't happen.
Last time out, it wasn't very good at all.
I thought Felix was not going to make that start on Thursday. I thought Erasmo was going to do it. I think, as it turns out, Erasmo just wasn't ready. Elias was on the disabled list. He ended up having, a triceps issue, and so he went on the DL. And I think they just didn't have another real option. I think they still think Felix gives them a better shot than Christian Bergman or whatever else they have in AAA. But eventually that's going to change. And I know Erasmo Ramirez is not the second coming of Cy Young or Walter Johnson, but he's been a capable major league pitcher here for the last few years. He's a guy who works hard, etc. And I think they're just done dealing with this Felix thing. Now, I don't know what's going to happen when they eventually pull the trigger on it. I don't know whether he's going to go to the bullpen or the disabled list or whether they're just going to have to release him and eat the contract here for the next year and a third. But at some point, this rubber is going to hit the road unless Felix, you know, pulls out an incredible vintage start on tomorrow night, throws 94 miles an hour the whole time and convinces everybody that he's back. And I think we all know that's unlikely to happen. And so what's going to occur with Felix Hernandez, to me, is fascinating to watch.
Boy, if they released him, that might be the most surprising, unexpected, out-of-nowhere storyline.
I don't think they'll do that. I think that it's possible that could happen in the offseason.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, with 1 year left on his deal, I'll tell you what, It's what I would probably do. You might be able to trade him for, you know, you eat almost the entirety of the salary and they give you back very little, but at least you save his dignity. Sort of what they did with Ichiro, right? Mm-hmm. And that turned out one of the guys they got back was Danny Farquhar. Turned out to be pretty good. But, you know, you might be able to pull a move like that where somebody gives you a, you know, a nominal prospect and they pick up $1.5 million of his salary just so that you can save face and he can save face. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And everybody looks okay. GM seemed to be willing to do that stuff for each other. And someone says, yeah, for $1.5 million and no real prospect, I'll take a flyer on Felix next year and see if he can pitch. And if he can't, you know, whatever. But what do you do with the rest of this year? I just keep thinking the best hope would be to put him on the disabled list and let him just ride out the year that way.
You don't want to try him in the bullpen at all, huh?
No, I don't. I don't think that makes a lot of sense. You?
I don't know. I've never seen him in the bullpen before. Nobody, I mean, I'm looking for, if I'm Jerry DePoto, and I'm in the situation I'm in, which, you know, meanwhile you're chasing this other team, a couple of teams in the playoff race, I'm trying to get a spark from anywhere I can.
Mm-hmm.
Watching Felix pitch, maybe you look at his stuff and you just think it's just not good enough at this point. But maybe moving him to the bullpen and seeing him contribute in that way. I mean, if they did put him in the bullpen, he would have an opportunity to make a big impact on this team because they could still use that kind of help.
I would guess, though, if he's in the bullpen, he'll be in a mop-up role. I mean, I don't think he's going to be there, you know, throwing high leverage spots in the seventh inning.
But he could be your high leverage in the sixth.
Maybe. I mean,
how deep are these starters going?
They've been going through six pretty regularly, don't you think?
Yeah, but that doesn't mean they will. I mean, you're talking about Gonzalez and Paxton.
I think for the most part, you've seen guys get into the sixth
inning. Into the sixth inning, maybe.
If not a little bit higher than that.
Into the sixth inning.
I don't know. There's some comparisons being made here. Oh, this is like Pedro's last year in Boston. Not really.
No, it's not.
Pedro had a 3.90 ERA.
He was 16-9. He was starting playoff games. You know what it's more similar to is Derek Lowe. I don't know if you guys really remember that, but he was one of their ace pitchers for a while. He was taken out of the rotation that year. And guess what? Three games in the playoffs and won them all.
It's true. It's really bizarre.
Baseball has a way of working things like that out. The only thing I'll say is that Felix, man, if you just watch last start, you watch his body language.
It doesn't seem like he's been motivated
at all. The ball's in the dirt. There's a shrug of the shoulders, looks at the ground. It just doesn't seem like it's there.
Yeah, I would agree with you. It's not so. It's the stuff. It's the body language. It's that there's been no indication that the enormousness of the situation or the urgency of the situation has dawned on him. That even though his manager has kind of let the world know and let Felix know, hey, man, it's all on the line here. I mean, he was asked about that the other day and whether or not that start felt different or more important to him. This is what he said. Cut 7.
Felix, did it feel like you were pitching for something more tonight?
I'm just trying to, you know, help the team win. So I wasn't thinking about anything else.
Yeah, I mean, look, I don't know whether to believe that. Obviously, anytime a player uses a cliche, it's hard to know whether that's real or not.
If Graz were here, he would probably tell you that he doesn't want the player. He doesn't want to hear from Felix. Well, I went out there, and he doesn't want to see him different than he normally is.
Well, what is normal now for Felix Hernandez? I want to see him like he used to be. I want to see a confident King Felix who knows what he's doing and has a nasty control and command of four pitches.
They can question whatever they want. I know who I am, and that's all I got to say.
But instead, you see a guy that seems like he's unhappy. I'm willing to bet he's not wild about the way this has gone with in the press over the last couple of weeks where he's been sort of back and forth. It seems like a super awkward situation. John's giving us a call in Duval, 206-421-3776. John, real quick.
Hey, good morning. Why not with Felix try the concept of bringing in the closer in the first inning or so? And let him calm down because he's clearly blowing it in the first couple innings.
You know, I've asked about that, John. I think it's a really interesting idea and maybe something you could try to work out in the offseason. I think the fear is twofold. One, it's something you're trying and experimenting with in the middle of a playoff run. It's generally not the way baseball teams behave. Not to say they couldn't or shouldn't, but it's generally not what they do. The other thing is that for the most part, the guys that are doing that in Tampa are really young players. You're not seeing their veteran. I mean, who's doing it? I mean, it's mostly young players that, you know, don't have much of a say in life. It's like, hey, here's your choices. We can either use you coming in the second inning or you can go back to AAA.
That's the tricky part about the star player situation is that there is still a certain way you have to treat him through all this. If he was anybody else, if he was Erasmo, and the numbers had been the same the whole year, he'd have been out of there a month ago.
Lloyd McLennan would have taken him out halfway through the third inning.
That's exactly
Forget
right.
this. Get out of my sight. I don't want to see anymore.
Of course, Lloyd might have had another option to go to also. Well, we don't really have that.
At this point, the Mariners really do not. So I'll be curious to see, first of all, how he pitches tomorrow, and then what the tone is of everybody talking around it. We'll wait and see. In the meantime, got some good news, bad news, no news next here. I'm excited for one little piece of news, and not just because of the word this person used to describe it. It's all next here. I'm Brock and Salk.
Good news.
Yeah!
Bad news. No news. Now, here's Brock and Salk.
Well, today it's Tom Wassel and Salk, at least. Brock's out for the day. He'll be back in tomorrow. We're over at Seahawks camp. It was nice to talk to Tedrick Thompson this morning, and it's beautiful out, man. It's just a great day to be out here as we get ready for a season. Preseason game starts on Thursday night. Guys, what's in the news?
Good news, bad news, no news.
The Mariners won yesterday to avoid the sweep. They're now 2.5 games behind the A's for the second wild card.
Good news, but I don't know how you can come into this week on a Monday after you just lost 3 of 4 to the Toronto Blue Jays and really have any kind of confidence moving forward. The Mariners, with their fans and maybe even to themselves, need to rebuild that equity, because it's not like they've just had a little slide here and there and some guys haven't hit or some guys haven't pitched. It's been a complete team effort, except the wrong way. It's all been negative. Just 10-13 record for July. When you have a great season, you're usually allowed one of those months. And up until yesterday, they hadn't won a game in the month of August yet. It's got to turn around right now.
Well, and it's going to get harder here going forward as the schedule gets tough. I know Texas is not that good, but you got to go there in the heat in August. And then from there straight to Houston and then to Oakland. That is a really challenging road trip, only to come back and play the Dodgers and Diamondbacks and Astros. I mean, there's a really tough road ahead here for the Mariners. But, you know, the good news, if I have to find it from the weekend, was pretty simple. Kyle Seager started to hit. He's had a couple of home runs yesterday, and really over the last couple of games, you've seen his bat look better. I know nobody looked very good on Saturday, but a couple of hits on Friday night, a couple of hits yesterday, even a hit when he came back, and he's been hitting the ball hard and with authority. They need that, and that's some good news for me.
Good news, bad news, no news.
Pete Carroll says Doug Baldwin will absolutely be ready to play for the season opener on September 9th.
He's no different than he was in the offseason. We just want to reconstruct his return to conditioning and all that kind of stuff, because he took a little bit of time off and we didn't quite handle that just right. So we just want to give him the chance to get back right with really good care and all that, knowing that he's fine.
I can't call that good news, man. I mean, maybe it's not quite bad news, but I certainly am not going to call it good news, and it's definitely not no news either. Look, Pete's got a weird way of wordsmithing injuries.
Reconstructing his return?
I know. He says things that no one has ever said before. And basically, what he's trying to say is, I don't want to tell you.
Yeah.
I mean, he's doing the same thing Bill Belichick does. He's just doing it nicely. And I don't need to rip him for it. I mean, I think that's absolutely the way you handle your business as a head coach in the NFL. There's no upside for him in giving us all the details on what's going on with Doug's recovery. But it doesn't sound like everything is just fine. And I think he's just being like Belichick, but nice.
I'll call it good news within the context of bad news, because Doug Baldwin, we talk about indispensable players on this team, and there aren't too many of them, but he's definitely one. We talked to Mike Sando about this before. He may be back for week one, but if he's in any way hobbled as the season goes on, that's going to be a problem.
Good news, bad news, no news.
Angels manager Mike Socha denied a report by The Athletic that he plans to resign at the end of the season, and he had an interesting way of describing it.
Nothing has changed since we talked in October. That's the best way I can put it. You were there.
I was.
Nothing has changed. And sometimes there's always chatter out there, and the only word I have for it is poppycock. That's what it is.
It's poppycock.
Mike, the floor is yours. This is your topic.
I just hate Mike.
This is like your birthday.
All right, I'm going to say this is bad news. The real news would be when somebody fires Mike Socha instead of allowing him to retire. Mike Socha is the most overrated coach or manager in all of sports and has been for a really long time. He has been essentially living on the success of an incredible bullpen that he had in 2002, and that's about it. I mean, like, he had one good team during that time.
Oh, that's not true.
Since then, his teams have been laden with talent, and and he has found a way to underperform in nearly every one of those years. He overmanages, his clubhouse generally doesn't care for him, and at the end of it, he just keeps getting year after year because he's got some sort of sway over Artie Moreno. Maybe some sort of Svengali or something. I don't know what his deal is, but I'll be very happy to see Mike Socha out of the league, even whether it's poppycock or not.
I'll say no news, but you have to give them some credit for their success along the way. You can't just say, well, every time they got to the playoffs, there's plenty of teams that have done that.
He's generally underperformed given the talent that he's had. And he has not developed young players particularly well either, short of Mike Trout, who's just awesome.
You know, the last couple of managers in baseball who I can recall having managed for that length of time, like Ron Gardenhire or Tom Kelly and Socha, they had more losing seasons than they did winning seasons, like by a long shot.
It is weird. It's like there's a group of guys out there who just exude baseball, and so they get these jobs forever. Look, nothing's got more of an old boys club than baseball, and Mike Socha is a second-generation guy, probably has about as much of it as anyone.
Good news, bad news, no news.
ESPN ranked the NFL teams with the most talent under the age of 25. No. The Seahawks were 31st.
That's not good. You probably want to be closer to, like, you know, first, right?
No
or
news.
Or like third or first, not 31st.
Okay.
What does that mean, talent? They ranked them according to how they were as players in college?
Well, under 25, they could have had a couple of years in the NFL. You can play 3 years in the NFL, 4 years by the time you're 25.
No news. I can't react to that. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I will say it's bad news, but with an opportunity to turn it around. I mean, look, the experts generally don't know until it hits them in the face. So, look, you would certainly rather that they recognize and have a tremendous amount of talent. But I don't think we all know this. The Seahawks are in the middle of this transitional period, and I don't know. I'm looking forward to seeing whether some of the talent that nobody respects is actually better than they think.
I think every team has got talent. Even the Browns have some talent year to year when it doesn't come together. It's a question of coaching and getting guys to work and personality and discipline and things like that that actually make it work at the end of the day.
Good news, bad news, no news.
Free agent cornerback Dominique Rodgers-Cromartie is reportedly scheduled to visit the Seahawks.
Tom, I got to give this one to you. He's a giant. This is your guy.
Yeah, I'd call it good news in the same way that I look at Brandon Marshall. This is a player who, when he first went to the Giants, he was probably past his prime at that point, but still contributed in a very significant way. I think he had 6 interceptions just a couple of years ago, but he's reached that point in his career where for a football player, you probably don't get it back.
Especially at that position.
Right.
I'm dramatic, man. I'm crazy.
You don't have a second career renaissance, generally.
What's his deal? Is he a good dude?
Last year, I think...
Antonio Cromartie, right?
No. I don't think so.
One thing about the locker room, man. When I come in here, man, I light it up.
There was something that went wrong, I think, with him and McAdoo, but that happened with, like, every player in Ben McAdoo. Before that, I think he was a very good locker room guy, leader-type guy, which is why I said good news. Good to have a guy like that maybe come in and work out, but...
Did they have some sort of sideline altercation?
Yeah, with
McAdoo?
Teammate?
With McAdoo?
Maybe. I don't remember. I only watched 4 games of that.
What's wrong with Ben McAdoo, man? Everybody hates that guy, huh? He's out, right?
He forgot how to call an offense once he became a head coach.
That's weird. Who's coaching the Giants now?
Pat Shurmur.
Oh, that should go well. All right, here you go. That's good news, bad news, no news every day at 8:45. Today with Wassel. I think we got some people on the horns. We may take some more calls on Felix. I know people are, you know, kind of intrigued. And what did you think? And where do you go from now? And why do you think the organization is kind of vacillating on this? Certainly take some more calls on that. 206-421-3776. And then Tom has created a fun game for us.
You still want to do that?
Oh, I want to do it.
Okay.
If you're going to create a game, Tom, I think you know that I'm pretty much up for it.
Well, it's not that good.
We'll take a few Felix calls, and then by about 9:15, we'll see if we can play Tom's fun game. We'll do it next. Don't go anywhere. It's Brock and Salk.
D.A. can't hold me back. D.A. can't hold me back.